She was a good Irish Catholic girl who had a child out of wedlock at age 18. With her mother dead, her father sent her to a convent in shame. And after a painful childbirth, she was forced to do 3 years of hard labor, 7 days a week at the convent as a penance for her sin. Her son, Anthony, was adopted at age 3 by an American family who were told by the convent that his parents were dead, and he was an orphan. Philomena Lee was devastated by the loss of her son, but she kept that deep pain and shame hidden for over 50 years. Following her release from the convent, she moved to England, where she married, had children, and served as a psychiatric nurse for over 30 years. Many years later, she tells her adult daughter, Jane, about Anthony. And Jane begins to search for him. At a party one night, she meets Martin Sixsmith, a journalist who's intrigued by the story and vows to help her find Anthony. Philomena reluctantly agrees to join in the search. The convent is no help. They say that all records of the adoptions from that period were burned in a fire. But Martin finds some clues in the United States through some connections he had from when he served as a correspondent there. He invites Philomena to join him on a trip to the States. She's never been, but she reluctantly agrees to join him. They discover that records of the adoption actually do exist, and that the convent had engaged in a series of elaborate deceptions of Philomena and Martin, and all the people in the United States involved in the adoption. Anthony's name had been changed to Michael, and Michael had died from AIDS several years earlier, after attempting to find his birth mother. In the midst of the journey, Philomena, in the film depicting her story, tells Martin that she needs to go to confession. And Martin, who's an agnostic, asks her why, and Philomena replies, "Because I'm a Catholic, and I'm a sinful person. Having Anthony was a sin. Keeping it a secret was a sin. And at times, I'm not sure which of those was worse." Martin says it's the church that should be confessing their sin to Philomena. But Philomena enters the confessional one day, but the words of confession don't come. Only tears of sadness and shame and deep hurt. She realizes in that moment it's not she who needs mercy, but the nuns. And she is the one to extend that mercy to them. And so she walks out of the confessional without blessing herself. And she and Martin return home to England, and then on to Ireland, and then to the convent. And they arrive, and Martin storms in, fuming, calling them out on their hypocrisy, their deceptions. But Philomena tells him to stop. And then she apologizes to the sisters for his behavior. And Martin yells, "Why are you apologizing to them?" And Philomena, calmly and assuredly, replies to Martin, "Because it happened to me, not you. And it's up to me to decide what to do." And Martin says, "So you're just going to do nothing?" And she replies, "No, I'm going to forgive." And she turns towards them and says, "Sisters, I want you to know that I forgive you." Martin can't believe it. "What? Just like that?" But Philomena sees a broader and deeper reality that's present. No, it's not just like that. It's a hard thing to do. But better that than living with the anger trapped inside of you, eating away at you. "I don't want to hate people. Look at you. I don't want to be like you." And Martin says, "But I'm angry." And Philomena sighs, looks at him with compassion and care, and says, "Yes, Martin, I know you're angry. It must be exhausting. Jesus enters exhausting territory in this collection of his famous sayings that we know as the Sermon on the Mount, the commandments. Are you just tired hearing that word? The Big Ten and beyond. Trying to live up to them is exhausting enough. But Jesus, as usual, takes us to a deeper level. He speaks of living into the commandments. He recognizes that beneath the surfaces of the commandments, there is a deeper and a broader reality. Within the letter of the law is startling and yet stretching spirit. He starts each part of the next section with the phrase, "You've heard that it was said," and then the commandment, followed by, "But I tell you," the underlying scope and spirit of the commandment. In the words from another great film, The Lion King, Rafiki, those words that he says to Simba really could apply to the words of Jesus here. When Jesus invites us to hear the commandments and then to listen harder. You shall not murder, or you shall not kill, in the Old King James. It seems pretty straightforward until Jesus digs deeper to reveal the motive behind the action. In this case, anger. And the sense here is not just sort of a universal sense of anger as a neutral, God-given emotion that can be expressed constructively or destructively, depending on how we choose. But there's a specific sense to the word anger here. It's giving the impression of more the kind of anger that's held onto and nursed. And we all know what we like to nurse from time to time: grudges. In this sense, then, the command is broken when we nurture a grudge against another person rather than nurturing a relationship with that person. It doesn't just involve physical violence, but emotional violence, relational violence. It's not just about killing others, but it's about potentially killing a relationship. And so then Jesus describes a kind of process of how anger can wreak havoc in our lives and in the lives of others. Say, for instance, someone or something pushes one of our internal buttons and makes us angry. That never happens, does it? But when it does, we get angry, but rather than acknowledging and owning the emotion before expressing it in a healthy or a constructive way, we stuff it. We bottle it up. We keep it deep inside of ourselves. But the nature of the emotion is that it's meant to be expressed and shared. And so gradually it starts coming out sideways, in sarcasm, even slightly humorous but biting ways. And then eventually the anger explodes out of us, in words, in actions that degrade the other person's character. They wound the other person. They can eventually destroy the relationship. And in the process, it has already ignited a fire of hatred within us that can end up destroying us from the inside out. That's the hell of fire Jesus is describing here, not some place far beyond. It's right inside of us. And we've lit the match. Frederick Buechner describes anger with these words: "Of the seven deadly sins, anger is possibly the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue the prospect of bitter confrontations still to come, to savor to the last toothsome morsel both the pain you are given and the pain you are giving back. In many ways, it's a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. Or as the saying that was made popular in the AA movement goes, holding on to anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Not exactly the yellow brick road to rainbows and unicorns. But thankfully, Jesus gives us another picture of a healthier way to respond to our anger. When we face and embrace our anger that's within, we can then respond instead of react by facing and even embracing the source of our anger with compassion, with mercy. And this really embodies not only the spirit of the command, but also the ultimate goal of the command, which is not just the prevention of violence, but ultimately the promotion of reconciliation, reconnection. The anger that we face and embrace and then express in healthy ways can empower us to actually be catalysts of that connection. We can be seed planters in our own lives and in the lives of others that can bring us and bring others back together. And we can feel that reconnection, not only with each other, but with our deepest selves and with our Creator and with the creation. All of the above. This is another example that Jesus gives us where he also flips convention on its ear, because you may notice in the example he gives that it's not the person holding the grudge who's called to be the impetus for this reconciliation, but the impetus is placed on the person against whom the grudge is being held. Jesus loves these phrases like the first will be last, the last will be first, the greatest will be least, the least will be greatest, not to create a new pecking order, but to mess with it. And to get us thinking beyond pecking orders. And I wonder if what Jesus is saying here is that ultimately, whether we are the perpetrator or the recipient of the hurt, we can still be the vessel, the instrument of the healing. So what makes us angry today? Maybe the better question is, what doesn't make us angry today? We're an angry society. We are inundated with so many potential triggers for anger and hurt. It can feel impossible to make it through a day without our tempers getting ready to flare, our blood starting to boil. Whether it's something we read in the news or it's a conversation we're trying to have with someone who sees an issue somewhat differently than we do. But then I ask myself the question, what do I do with that anger? What do you do with that anger? What do we do with that anger? And maybe the corollary as well, what does that anger do with us and within us? Holding on to that anger can be exhausting. But facing that anger, embracing it, and then expressing it in helpful and healthy ways can not only be exhilarating, even more empowering, it can be empowering. And so the question perhaps for each of us is, are you holding a grudge today? Is someone holding a grudge against you? The invitation is to take the first step. Face your anger. Acknowledge it. Embrace your anger. Own it. And then release it to the one who knows you and loves you. The one who has had to endure more anger than anyone else in known history. You may even want to take that anger and bring it up with you to this table of welcome and acceptance and celebration and release that we will be gathering around in a few moments. and allow that step to empower you to take the next step towards that person or that situation to be a catalyst for connection. To not be trapped in resentment, but to move further and further towards reconciliation. After communion, our choir will then share a powerful poem and beautiful song that is another invitation into this incredible journey of reconciliation, a dance of freedom and joy that comes from facing and embracing and releasing what can weigh us down. And so the invitation is to come. Come, all who are exhausted and needing encouragement. Come, all who are holding on to anger and what's underneath anger, pain and hurt and woundedness. Come and experience the freedom to let go and to let be and to let God be God and empower you to be you and me to be me. Come to this table and experience that acceptance and release, that freedom and peace. Come, all who are seekers of reconciliation. Amen.